From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Dark Dream by Elizabeth Vancett. This is the hour that I used to love, soft in the early morning, the sun fresh risen in the east, when the sands are gentle warm and the days cool, and even the sea is comparatively calm and peaceful and safe. Soon the sun will be hot and high, the beach a burning bed on which a thousand bodies lays and lie before they run to shed the scorch of day within the welcome coolness of the shining, rolling, thundering sea. Today will be a good surfing day, like many others we have known and he has loved, since we made this golden land, our home. How readily and with what skill and ease he took to this tremendous ocean, challenging it, mastering it, making it his own. Sometimes it frightens me how much he loves the sea. I do not share his love, and I swim no more powerfully than a child, and while he rides the rearing rolling waters, I remain at the ocean's edge, among the laughing, playing children, content to watch and laugh with them, as they run from the mighty breakers, roaring into twist and lift their small brown bodies, and toss them up like leaves onto the cool and golden sands. But without him, I would not go even to the water's edge, and always there is a fear in me, a secret dread of this enormous ocean, so seeming blue in sunlight, so dark, so deep out there beyond these gentle shores. And fear seeps into sleep, and dreams are fashioned, turning those fears into thoughts and the thoughts into images, and the night takes up the living dreads of day, takes, draws out, reforms into some monstrous pattern that the waking mind could never dare to contemplate. The night before he went away, I had such a dream. I was here on this beach, waiting for his return, but it was later in the day than now, and the sun was hot and high. I stood at the ocean's edge among the laughing, playing children, but I did not play and I did not laugh. I watched him as he waited, 60 or 70 yards out, among the other surfers to catch the next great breaker. I knew that he would take it easily, skillfully, in perfect balance, riding splendidly the fierce and foaming giant. I watched with love and pride, pride in his strength, his skill, his graceful tallness, and I watched with fear. I saw the waves come sweeping in, swelling and rising, an enormous white-tipped wall of water, as it came racing, rolling across the great ocean. As the giant breakers reared behind him, the man next to him was spun into his path. I saw them both go down, the waves closing over. Presently they surfaced apart, struck out to retrieve their skis. He was swimming strongly, his powerful form cutting through the buffeting waves, was almost to his ski and reaching out for it, when suddenly was flung high and violently out of the sea. For one brief moment I saw the sunlight glinting on his brown body as he hurtled into the air, and then he fell back and I could not see him. But I knew where he fell the sea was no longer blue, but red. And there was a shout about me and cries of, "Shark! Shark!" And a bell was ringing way back upon the beach, and there were cries and screams of panic and of warning, and the people in the sea were swimming desperately away from the danger, away from the widening blood-red patch of foam, away from him, away from him. And the children screamed and scrambled from the sea, and soon there were no people in the water or at its edge save me. I could not hear his screams of pain, but I knew that he must be screaming, writhing in an agony of terror and a grotesquely fearsome oneness with that great dark shape beneath the waters, its teeth locked tight about his brown limb, spinning him around like a mad dog with a bone, trying to wrench the limb away. And then there were lifeguards running, and one already in the belt, and others coming, but I was no longer on the shore. I was racing into the surf, tearing through the first great breaker, my one thought to reach him, to be with him, to die with him. I surfaced, choking beyond the breaker, swimming strongly, swimming desperately through the deep, tempestuous ocean that I so feared and hated, until my arms and legs were aching, straining, weakening. But I would not let my body weaken, nor the buffeting, bruising, contemptuous sea hold me back from my beloved. I was near now, close to the blood-red patch of foam. I trod water, easing my aching limbs, calling his name, willing him to rise above the ever-reddening foam. I called his name. I shrieked it. I could not hear my voice above the surf's roar. I could not see him, but he was there, struggling beneath the madly swirling water, as a thing beneath threshed and twisted and spun him savagely around, trying to tear his limb away. A huge wave came rolling in, lifted me, smothered me, almost drowned me. I fought to surface, clawing upward, my eyes, my mouth full of sea. I rose, choking, blinded, my lungs bursting, my ears deafened with the roar of the endless thundering sea. And suddenly there he was, his dear face white, agonized, and the water about him red with his blood. The water was full of blood. I was close, so close. His hands reached out to me. I caught them, held them briefly before I felt a tremendous tug upon my straining arms, and I knew then that the shark had torn his limb away. His eyes closed in agony beyond describing, and I could not hold him, and his hand slid away from mine, and he sank once more beneath the richly reddening foam, and the water was full of blood. Then there was movement about me, and a face close to mine, and other hands reaching out to me, and I was screaming out his name, and I tried to dive beneath that blood-red sea to find him, hold him, die with him. But I was caught and held in strong, relentless hands, and suddenly I saw his face again, a gray blob upon the surface of the sea, his eyes closed tight in agony or shock or death, I knew not which. And then the great high sun was a glaring fire above me, and the sea a roar and a rage about my face and body, as I was pulled in a breathless rush of speed through the stinging, blinding, smothering waters. And somewhere I could hear a cry, and voices shouting, warning, and I knew that the shark was following the trail of bloodied water, in the trail of him. And then I was lying on the sands, and my mind was screaming that this could not, must not be, and that the morning soon would come and wake me from this dark and fearsome dream. And in my dream I was filled with dread that the morning would not come before I was forced to see its final horror. And the dream went on, and I saw his brown and bloodied body lying there on the swiftly reddening sands, the blood still pouring from the raw and hideous wound where the shark had ripped his leg away. And they did not have to tell me that my beloved was dead. And then it was morning, and the sun was high, and he had left me to catch his early plane. He had gone quietly, without waking me, for he knows that I hate partings, however brief. I woke to another week away from him. But this is his job, that is our life, one that he had always wanted in this new enormous land of sun and sands and blue-white surfing waters. Today he is returning. That is why I wait here on this beach in this bright and savage sunny place where dark shapes lurk in the darker waters beneath the blue-white breakers of the mighty sea. This is where he will find me, today when he returns. This has always been our custom, and despite my fears, our joy. And we would run and laugh together across the burning sands. We would run toward the waiting sea, and soon he would be where the giant breakers rise and rear beneath the surge and swell of it, the rising roar and roll of it, challenging, taking, riding it, and I would not have him be afraid, as I was afraid of this blue and endless sea. But now, will I tell him of my dream, that by telling it, it shall not come to pass? Can one prevent that which will happen? This is against all reason. Yet I must try. Yes, I must try. although I know no power on earth or in heaven can alter what will be. But will it be? Maybe it was only a warning dream, and yet, how can I tell him? Will I tell him? Will he not laugh teasingly and say, all surfers know there may be sharks around. That's all part of the fun, the danger. And he will say, trying to calm my fears. At least that's what we kid ourselves. But we all know that the real man-eaters, the blue pointers, haven't been around these coasts for years. And he will say, seeing that I'm still afraid, forget it, darling. Dreams are just things that pass away with night and never, never come true. Already the sun is aglare and high, swift and fierce in its rising, the fire and bright and burn of its haze of whiteness above the golden sands. The sea that merely moved and murmured in the cool calmness of the morning now rolls and stirs and summons up its awful power in the dark and dreadful deeps beyond the waiting empty shore. There is something wrong about the day. A few people scattered here and there about the sands, a child or two playing in small safe pools along the shore. But there is no one in the sea. No one swims. No small brown bodies dare the tumbling roller sweeping in toward the shoreline. Out at sea, a helicopter hovers. Circles, flies on. There is a hush awaiting, a sense of danger, fear. I notice now that the warning flags are crossed against each other. Though I do not know the reason for them, I am grateful for the flags. At least today there will be no surfing. He will be disappointed, but he will not surf today. There is a large notice further down the beach, too far away for me to read. I see some lifeguards sitting, talking outside the club rooms. There is movement, a face in the shark tower. I stroll toward the notice, read the bold words largely printed. Killer shark off the coastline. All swimming, surfing prohibited until further notice. Killer shark? Two words of terror, warning, telling the world, telling him, in the full clear light of the unsleeping, dreamless day. There should be fear, horror in my eyes. Instead, they shine with joy. There should be ice in my heart. Instead, it is warm light. It leaps, surges, sings. For it was, after all, a warning dream. No need now to tell him. No need now to try in desperate fear to make him heed the warning. For now that we know, it can be prevented. It need not happen. This is real. This is notice. Real these words, this sign that he can read, this order that he must obey. A tall bronze man comes striding down the beach. My heart leaps. My feet tiptoe to run to meet him. But I see now it is just another lifeguard, making for the group by the clubhouse. I do not know him. I think he must be new at this beach. As he draws near, he glances curiously at me. I know that I'm smiling, but I cannot help it. Do you think you'll catch him? I ask, pointing to the warning sign. His face is grim. We're gunning for him, he says, not only here, but all along this coastline. I stare at him. I had not thought of that. Why had I supposed it would be here, on this beach? The lifeguard is saying, no one's going to like the ban, of course, and I don't doubt some of them will try elsewhere. But at least there'll be no more surfing or swimming from this beach until the brute is caught. My heart is cold. What if he were to try another beach, to beat the ban as many surfers would do? My heart is ice. It still could happen, as in my dream. It still could be. I walk with him towards the other lifeguards. I know them all, vaguely by sight. But there is one. My heart thumps painfully. His was the face close to mine. His the arms that held me, stayed me, kept me from dying with my love. This was the man who had held me close as I waited, screaming for my dream to end. Yes, this was the beach. This the place of which I had been warned. I'm calm now, my heart eased with the knowledge that this brings. It would not be elsewhere but here, if it were to happen. And it will not happen. It will not be, and I must not dwell upon the dream again. It is done with. Forget it. I try to break my thoughts to listen to what the lifeguard is saying as we draw near to the group by the clubhouse. but memory of the dream persists, and I see again the swirling waters where the dark shape threshed and spun him around, rugging, wrenching, tearing beneath the ever-reddening foam. I hear again the surf's relentless roar, feel that dreadful rug upon my arms, see his face white with agony, his eyes full of pain and horror, his blood on the waters, his blood on the sand. I hate to see. My sudden cry startles my companion. Then he shrugs. These things don't often happen, he says. But when they do, I think we all hate the sea. I would never come, I say, except to be with my husband. He comes here regularly, every day, in fact. He loves the sea. He turns, looks at me. You were here, maybe? He asks. Saw it happen? I'm sorry if you did. It must have been a grim experience. What? I ask. See, what happened? I was just telling you. The brutes already made a killing. Oh, no. My voice is horror shocked, my heart tight with horror, that already someone has known the reality of terror I have only known in dream. I haven't been here for a while, I tell him shakily. My husband has been away. It happened last week, he is saying. Not 60 yards out. A blue pointer it was, an enormous brute. It had a girth of... He broke off apologetically. I'm sorry, you don't want to hear about it. But again, I'm not really listening. My gaze is fixed on the familiar face of the lifeguard in the group by the clubhouse. He turns, looks at me as we draw near. He is speaking now softly, quietly to one of his companions, who also turns, looks at me. He leaves the group, approaches me. You shouldn't be here, he is saying. His voice is gruff, his face grave concern. It's all right, I answer. I'm waiting for my husband. He's been away, you see. I know that he can't surf today, and I'm glad. Glad of the shark. In a way, that is. I don't want anyone to be hurt, and I'm sorry about the accident, but I'm glad he won't be allowed to surf because he wouldn't pay heed to silly dreams. And last week, I had this dream, just before he went away. And then I'm telling him of my dream, eagerly in a rush and spill of anguish words, glad to speak of it, wanting to speak of it, knowing the need. And his eyes are full of pity as he listens, and his face is dark and grave, as through my words I live again that fearsome dream of his dark and dreadful death, and spare myself no smallest detail and the grim remembering, until I'm screaming that this could not, must not be, and the white-hot sands bite deep into my body as I fling myself still screaming to the burning ground, crying out for the morning soon to come and put an end to dreaming. And then he's lifting me, soothing me, cradling me close tight, and I look up into the familiar face of the man who holds me, as he held me then on that hot and savage sunny day, and I know that the morning will not come, and the dream will never, never end. Lamb to Slaughter by Roald Dahl. The room was warm and clean, the curtains drawn, the two table lamps alight, hers and the one by the empty chair opposite. On the sideboard behind her, two tall glasses, soda water, whiskey, fresh ice cubes in the thermos bucket. Mary Maloney, she would glance up at the clock, but without anxiety, merely to please herself with the thought that each minute gone by made it nearer the time when he would come. There was a slow, smiling air about her, about everything she did. The drop of the head as she bent over her sewing was curiously tranquil. Her skin, for this was her 6th month with child, had acquired a wonderful translucent quality. The mouth was soft, and the eyes, with a new placid look, seemed larger, darker than before. When the clock said 5:10, she began to listen, and a few moments later, punctually as always, she heard the tires on the gravel outside and the car door slamming, the footsteps passing the window, the key turning in the lock. She laid aside her sewing, stood up, and went forward to kiss him as he came in. "Hello, darling," she said. "Hello," he answered. She took his coat and hung it in the closet. Then she walked over and made the drinks, a strongish one for him, a weak one for herself, and soon she was back again in her chair with sewing, and he and the other opposite holding the tall glass with both his hands, rocking it so the ice cubes tinkled against the side. For her, this was always a blissful time of day. She knew he didn't want to speak much until the first drink was finished, and she, on her side, was content to sit quietly, enjoying his company after the long hours alone in the house. She loved to luxuriate in the presence of this man and to feel, almost as a sunbather feels the sun, that warm male glow that came out of him to her when they were alone together. She loved him for the way he sat loosely in a chair, for the way he came in a door or moved slowly across the room with long strides. She loved the intent, far look in his eyes when they rested on her, the funny shape of the mouth, and especially the way he remained silent about his tiredness, sitting still with himself until the whiskey had taken some of it away. "Tired, darling?" "Yes," he said, "I'm tired." And as he spoke, he did an unusual thing. He lifted his glass and drained it in one swallow, although there was still half of it, at least half of it left. She wasn't really watching him, but she knew what he had done because she heard the ice cubes falling back against the bottom of the empty glass when he lowered his arm. He paused a moment, leaning forward in the chair, then got up and went slowly over to fetch himself another. "I'll get it," she cried, jumping up. "Sit down," he said. When he came back, she noticed that the new drink was dark amber with a quantity of whiskey in it. "Darling, shall I get your slippers?" "No." She watched him as he began to sip the dark yellow drink, and she could see little oily swirls in the liquid because it was so strong. "I think it's a shame," she said, "that when a policeman gets to be as senior as you, they keep him walking about on his feet all day long." He didn't answer. So she bent her head again and went on with her sewing. But each time he lifted the drink to his lips, she heard the ice cubes clinking against the side of the glass. "Darling," she said, "would you like me to get you some cheese? I haven't made any supper because it's Thursday." "No," he said. "If you're too tired to eat out," she went on, "it's still not too late. There's plenty of meat and stuff in the freezer, and you can have it right here and not even move out of the chair." Her eyes waited on him for an answer. A smile, a little nod, but he made no sign. "Anyway," she went on, "I'll get you some cheese and crackers first." "I don't want it," he said. She moved uneasily in her chair, the large eyes still watching his face. "But you must have supper. I can easily do it here. I'd like to do it. We can have lamb chops or pork, anything you want. Everything's in the freezer." "Forget it," he said. "But darling, you must eat." "I'll fix it anyway, and then you can have it or not, as you like." She stood up and placed her sewing on the table by the lamp. "Sit down," he said, "just for a minute, sit down." It wasn't until then that she began to get frightened. "Go on," he said, "sit down." She lowered herself back slowly into the chair, watching him all the time with those large, bewildered eyes. He had finished the second drink and was staring down into the glass, frowning. "Listen," he said, "I've got something to tell you." "What is it, darling? What's the matter?" He had now become absolutely motionless, and he kept his head down so that the light from the lamp beside him fell across the upper part of his face, leaving the chin and mouth in shadow. She noticed there was a little muscle moving near the corner of his left eye. "This is going to be a bit of a shock to you, I'm afraid," he said. "But I've thought about it a good deal, and I've decided the only thing to do is tell you right away. I hope you won't blame me too much." And he told her. It didn't take long, 4 or 5 minutes at most, and she sat very still through it all, watching him with a kind of dazed horror as he went further and further away from her with each word. "So there it is," he added. "And I know it's kind of a bad time to be telling you, but there simply wasn't any other way. Of course, I'll give you money and see you're looked after, but there needn't really be any fuss. I hope not anyway. It wouldn't be very good for my job." Her first instinct was not to believe any of it, to reject it all. It occurred to her that perhaps he hadn't even spoken, that she herself had imagined the whole thing. Maybe if she went about her business and acted as though she hadn't been listening, then later, when she sort of woke up again, she might find none of it had ever happened. "I'll get to supper," she managed to whisper, and this time he didn't stop her. When she walked across the room, she couldn't feel her feet touching the floor. She couldn't feel anything at all except a slight nausea and a desire to vomit. Everything was automatic now. Down the steps to the cellar, the light switched the deep freeze, the hand inside the cabinet, taking hold of the first object it met. She lifted it out and looked at it. It was wrapped in paper, so she took off the paper and looked at it again. A leg of lamb. All right then, they would have lamb for supper. She carried it upstairs, holding the thin bone end of it with both hands, and as she went through the living room, she saw him standing over by the window with his back to her, and she stopped. "For God's sake," he said, hearing her but not turning around, "don't make supper for me. I'm going out." At that point, Mary Maloney simply walked up behind him, and without any pause, she swung the big frozen leg of lamb high in the air and brought it down as hard as she could on the back of his head. She might just as well have hit him with a steel club. She stepped back a pace, waiting, and the funny thing was that he remained standing there for at least 4 or 5 seconds, gently swaying, then he crashed to the carpet. The violence of the crash, the noise, the small table overturning, helped to bring her out of the shock. She came out slowly, feeling cold and surprised, and she stood for a while blinking at the body, still holding the ridiculous piece of meat tight with both hands. "All right," she told herself, "so I've killed him." It was extraordinary, now how clear her mind became all of a sudden. She began to think very fast. As the wife of a detective, she knew quite well what the penalty would be. That was fine. It made no difference to her. In fact, it would be a relief. On the other hand, what about the child? What were the laws about murderers with unborn children? Did they kill them both, mother and child? Or did they wait until the 10th month? What did they do? Mary Maloney didn't know, and she certainly wasn't prepared to take a chance. She carried the meat into the kitchen, placed it in a pan, turned the oven on high, and shoved it inside. Then she washed her hands and ran upstairs to the bedroom. She sat down before the mirror, tidied her hair, touched up her lips and face. She tried to smile. It came out rather peculiar. She tried again. "Hello, Sam," she said brightly, aloud. The voice sounded peculiar, too. "I want some potatoes, please, Sam. Yes, and I think a can of peas." That was better. Both the smile and the voice were coming out better now. She rehearsed it several times more. Then she ran downstairs, took her coat, went out the back door, down the garden, into the street. It wasn't 6 o'clock yet, and the lights were still out in the grocery shop. "Hello, Sam," she said brightly, smiling at the man behind the counter. "Why, good evening, Mrs. Maloney. How are you?" "I want some potatoes, please, Sam. Yes, and I think a can of peas." The man turned and reached up behind him on the shelf for the peas. "Patrick decided he's tired and doesn't want to eat out tonight," she told him. "We usually go out Thursdays, you know, and now he's caught me without any vegetables in the house." "Then how about meat, Mrs. Maloney?" "No, I've got meat, thanks. I got a nice leg of lamb from the freezer." "Oh, I don't much like cooking it frozen, Sam, but I'm taking a chance on it this time. You think it'll be all right?" "Personally," the grocer said, "I don't believe it makes any difference. You want these Idaho potatoes?" "Oh, yes, that'll be fine. 2 of those. "Anything else?" The grocer cocked his head on one side, looking at it pleasantly. "How about afterwards? What are you going to give him for afterwards?" "Well, what would you suggest, Sam?" The man glanced around his shop. "How about a nice big slice of cheesecake?" "I know he likes that." "Perfect," she said. "He loves it." And when it was all wrapped and she had paid, she put on her brightest smile and said, "Thank you, Sam. Good night." "Good night, Mrs. Maloney, and thank you." And now, she told herself as she hurried back, all she was doing now, she was returning home to her husband, and he was waiting for supper, and she must cook it good and make it as tasty as possible, because the poor man was tired, and if when she entered the house she happened to find anything unusual or tragic or terrible, then naturally it would be a shock, and She had become frantic with grief and horror. Mind you, she wasn't expecting to find anything. She was just going home with the vegetables on Thursday evening to cook supper for her husband. That's the way, she told herself. Do everything right and natural. Keep things absolutely natural, and there'll be no need for any acting at all. Therefore, when she entered the kitchen by the back door, she was humming a little tune to herself and smiling. Patrick, she called. How are you, darling? She put the parcel down on the table and went through into the living room, and when she saw him lying down on the floor with his legs doubled up and one arm twisted back underneath his body, it really was rather a shock. All the old love and longing for him welled up inside her, and she ran over to him, knelt down beside him, and began to cry her heart out. It was easy. No acting was necessary. A few minutes later, she got up and went to the phone. She knew the number of the police station, and when the man at the other end asked, she cried to him, "Quick! Come quick! Patrick's dead!" "Who's speaking?" "Mrs. Maloney. Mrs. Patrick Maloney."
"You mean Patrick Maloney's dead?"
"I think so," she sobbed. "He's lying on the floor, and I think he's dead."
"Be right over," the man said.
The car came very quickly, and when she opened the front door, two policemen walked in. She knew them both. She knew nearly all the men at the precinct. And she fell right into Jack Noonan's arm, weeping hysterically. He put her gently into a chair, then went over to join the other one, who was called O'Malley, kneeling by the body.
"Is he dead?" she cried.
"I'm afraid he is. What happened?" Briefly, she told her story about going out to the grocer and coming back to find him on the floor. While she was talking, crying and talking, Noonan discovered a small patch of congealed blood on the dead man's head. He showed it to O'Malley, who got up at once and hurried to the phone. Soon, other men began to come into the house. First a doctor, then two detectives, one of whom she knew by name. Later, a police photographer arrived and took pictures, and a man who knew about fingerprints. There was a great deal of whispering and muttering beside the corpse, and the detectives kept asking her a lot of questions. But they always treated her kindly. She told her story again, this time right from the beginning, when Patrick had come in and she was sewing, and he was tired, so tired he hadn't wanted to go out for supper. She told him how she'd put the meat in the oven. "It's there now, cooking," and how she'd slipped out to the grocer for vegetables and come back to find him lying on the floor. "Which grocer?" one of the detectives asked. She told him, and he turned and whispered something to the other detective, who immediately went outside into the street. In 15 minutes he was back with a page of notes, and there was more whispering, and through her sobbing she heard a few of the whispered phrases. "Acted quite normal, very cheerful, wanted to give him a good supper, peas, cheesecake." "Impossible," that she. After a while the photographer and the doctor departed, and two other men came in and took the corpse away on a stretcher. Then the fingerprint man went away. The two detectives remained, and so did the two policemen. They were exceptionally nice to her, and Jack Noonan asked if she wouldn't rather go somewhere else, to her sister's house perhaps, or to his own wife, who would take care of her and put her up for the night. "No," she said. She didn't feel she could move even a yard at the moment. Would they mind awfully if she stayed just where she was until she felt better? She didn't feel too good at the moment. She really didn't. "Then hadn't she better lie down on the bed?" Jack Noonan asked. "No," she said. She'd like to stay right where she was, in this chair. A little later, perhaps, when she felt better, she would move. So they left her there while they went about their business searching the house. Occasionally, one of the detectives asked her another question. Sometimes Jack Noonan spoke to her gently as he passed by. Her husband, he told her, had been killed by a blow on the back of the head, administered with a heavy, blunt instrument, almost certainly a large piece of metal. They were looking for the weapon. The murderer may have taken it with him, but on the other hand, he may have thrown it away or hidden it somewhere on the premises. "It's the old story," he said. "Get the weapon, and you've got the man." Later, one of the detectives came up and sat beside her. "Did she know," he asked, "of anything in the house that could have been used as the weapon? Would she mind having a look around to see if anything was missing? A very big wrench, for example, or a heavy metal vase?" "They didn't have any metal vases," she said.
"Or a big wrench?"
She didn't think they had a big wrench, but there might be some things like that in the garage. The search went on. She knew that there were other policemen in the garden all around the house.
She could hear their footsteps on the gravel outside, and sometimes she saw the flash of a torchlight through a chink in the curtain. It began to get late, nearly 9, she noticed by the clock on the mantel. The 4 men searching the room seemed to be growing weary, a trifle exasperated. Jack, she said the next time Sergeant Noonan went by, would you mind giving me a drink?
Sure, I'll give you a drink.
You mean this whiskey?
Yes, please, but just a small one. It might make me feel better.
He handed her the glass.
Why don't you have one yourself, she said. You must be awfully tired.
Please do. You've been very good to me.
Well, he answered, it's not strictly allowed, but I might take just a drop to keep me going.
One by one, the others came in and were persuaded to take a little nip of whiskey. They stood around rather awkwardly with the drinks in their hands, uncomfortable in her presence, trying to say consoling things to her. Sergeant Noonan wandered into the kitchen, came out quickly and said,
look, Mrs. Maloney, you know that oven of yours is still on and the meat still inside.
Oh, dear me, she cried, so it is.
I'd better turn it off for you, hadn't I? Will you do that, Jack? Thank you so much.
When the sergeant returned the second time, she looked at him with her large, dark, tearful eyes.
Jack Noonan, she said.
Yes?
Would you do me a small favor, you and these others?
We can try, Mrs. Maloney.
Well, she said, here you all are, and good friends of dear Patrick's too, and helping to catch the man who killed him. You must be terribly hungry by now, because it's long past your supper time, and I know Patrick would never forgive me, God bless his soul, if I allowed you to remain in his house without offering you decent hospitality. Why don't you eat up the lamb that's in the oven? It'll be cooked just right by now.
Wouldn't dream of it, Sergeant Noonan said.
Please, she begged, please eat it. Personally, I couldn't touch a thing, certainly not what's been in the house when he was here. But it's all right for you. It'd be a favor to me if you'd eat it up. Then you can go on with your work again afterwards.
There was a good deal of hesitating among the 4 policemen, but they were clearly hungry, and in the end they were persuaded to go into the kitchen and help themselves. The woman stayed where she was, listening to them through the open door, and she could hear them speaking amongst themselves, their voices thick and sloppy because their mouths were full of meat.
Have some more, Charlie?
No, better not finish it.
She wants us to finish it. She said so. Be doing her a favor.
Okay, then. Give me some more.
That's a hell of a big club the guy must have used to hit poor Patrick, one of them was saying. The doc says his skull was smashed all to pieces, just like from a sledgehammer.
That's why it ought to be easy to find.
Exactly what I say.
Whoever done it, they're not going to be carrying a thing like that around with them longer than they need to.
One of them belched. Personally, I think it's right here on the premises.
Probably right under our very noses.
What do you think, Jack?
And in the other room, Mary Maloney began to giggle.